So some of you probably weren't here last week. Who wasn't here last week? Quite a few of you. Did you manage to catch it on YouTube? Some of you? No. So I'll do a little recap anyway. I'll do a little recap. So last week we started in a way, trying to bring some of the strands together that we've been looking at. So what I was saying last week in sort of summary was that in the first week I was talking about this delusion, this sort of fundamental core root delusion that we have that keeps consciousness contracted, that keeps it from expanding and unfolding to its, as it were, natural state. Can anybody remember what that delusion is? Yes, that we're fixed and separate. That we sort of exist as entities. That's the kind of root delusion. That there's a real me. And when I say I, I'm referring to some sort of fixed and separate entity in the universe. And from a Buddhist perspective, it's not that we don't exist, but we don't exist in that fixed and separate way, not ultimately. So if you think about a river flowing, you can, from a superficial perspective, point to a river and say, there it is, that's the River Thames, it's flowing towards the sea, or whatever. But when you look from a more closer, more absolute, more scientific perspective, the river is just a label, isn't it? It's a label for a process of constant flow. There's nothing fixed that you can ever say remains the same. And what's more, that constant flow, there's nothing about it that's ultimately separate from its environment. It's flow because it's connected to its environment. So where does the river end, and where does its banks begin? Where does the river end, and where does the sea begin? Where does when you look at boundaries from a sort of absolute perspective, they start to not be so clear. In fact, they're always changing. What do we mean by the river anyway? Because the water's always new. It's always evaporating. It's always fresh. It's always coming into it. Do we include the eddies and the currents and the life in the river? Is that part of the river? What about the rocks? What about the erosion? There's just flow, and for convenience sake, for the sake of language, we make distinctions, we draw boundaries, we have labels, we have this artificial way of talking, which suffices for everyday practical purposes. You can say the river. Similarly, for everyday purposes, I can say me, Jnanavacha, and I can say you, Idoya, and you lot are out there and I'm in here. For everyday practical purposes, that sort of works. But it's not the ultimate truth. It's not ultimate reality. It's fine for practical purposes, but it's when we start to take a convention for absolute reality that it all starts to go wrong. One of the first consequences of taking that conventional label of self for absolutely true truth is that consciousness contracts around that delusion. Self is a construct, just as river is a construct. And as soon as we take it literally and believe in it, consciousness contracts around it. And that contraction of mind is inherently painful. Because we live like that all the time, we don't even notice that it's painful. until maybe things go wrong in our life. But actually, even without things going wrong in our life, from the enlightened perspective, that contraction is inherently painful. If we could experience the freedom of a blissfully open mind, then in comparison, we'd just feel imprisoned by this contracted mind. It's just because we don't often experience the expansiveness that we have no comparison. I guess people do have moments of expansiveness. I mean, you probably have had experiences either in meditation or in nature or at times of crisis or even through artificial stimulants. You can probably experience expansive states of mind. Do you know what I'm talking about? Who has experienced something more expansive? Well, that's almost everybody in the room. And the trouble is that they can be like peak experiences in our life. Maybe, I don't know, when we fall in love, for example, or first love, we can have this kind of peak experience. The world is beautiful. Our mind is expansive. But those peak experiences don't last, and we don't know how to make the most of them. We treat them as if they were, I don't know, fluke. Whereas actually, they're pointing to our natural state. They're pointing to our birthright. They're pointing to what consciousness truly can be if we didn't keep contracting. So I was talking about that root delusion in the first week. And then what I was talking about last week was that as soon as we have this delusion and the mind is narrowed, as soon as we've done that, we start to experience painful and negative mental states based on this delusion. Traditionally, what we experience is states of mind that want to protect this idea of a me as a separate entity. And anything that threatens that me, we push away and we experience aversion, anger, hatred, all of those things that are about pushing away anything that threatens our identity, my identity. And of course, we want to fill this identity with more and more satisfaction. So then we get into craving, we get into greed and you know, addiction, craving, whatever it is. They're natural. Of course we want to be happy. And Buddhism doesn't make a problem of wanting to be happy. What it says is that this craving and hatred is actually preventing us from being happy because it reinforces the narrowness of mind. Yeah? It keeps on becoming a vicious circle. And it gets worse because what happens is that from a narrow mind that's dark with ignorance, with craving, with hatred or whatever it is, with self-centeredness, from that mind we then act in the world. We communicate with others, we go about our business, we act in the world. In fact, we build a life on it, don't we? We try and build a life that is going to satisfy this hunger that we feel based on a delusion, and consequently, life never quite works. We think we'll get fulfillment, complete satisfaction, that this me can be fully satisfied if only I get the right job, the career, the partner, I don't know, the house, the possessions, the car, the holiday. Whatever it is, we just think, oh yeah, let me just get it all right and then life will be perfect. We forget that actually we don't exist as a static entity and there's nothing fixed, not just about us, but about the universe. Even if you have that perfect life, it won't last because it's not fixed. How can it? And folks, it's going to end in death. So, you know, let's think about that. What are we trying to do to get this perfect life, to fix it? For what? Yeah? Instead, there is a real fulfillment to be had. And that real fulfillment is to be found in the mind, unleashed from these bonds and becoming free and expansive. And when it's free and expansive, it's also blissful, it's also creative, it's also radiant, and that radiance affects everything we experience. Everything becomes radiant. That is our potential. And when we experience that expansiveness, that radiance, it kind of doesn't matter what sort of car we have or job we have. And actually what emerges is love. What emerges is metta, spontaneously and naturally, for everybody, for all beings, for all life. Isn't that a wonderful vision of what it could be to be human? Now, it's a vision that is within the potential for all of us, but it's not straightforward to achieve. It's not going to be straightforward to root out this delusion. I was talking last week about how deep it goes, and it goes as deep as the survival instinct. So imagine the survival instinct and how deep that is. That survival instinct gives you a sense of what this illusion, how deep it goes. It's not just a conscious, I mean, consciousness is just tiny, it's thin. This instinct is vast and deep. So then there's a path. What I was saying, one model of the Buddhist path is called the Threefold Path. And you start, you reverse this trend. So you start with our actions, with our relationships with other people, with our relationships with the environment and world around us. And we try to act from less self-centeredness. In fact, we try to act from kindness and generosity as much as we can. So that starts to sort of hook this self-attachment, this self-centeredness and this attachment to me. It starts to loosen it at least. But that probably isn't enough. Well, it won't be enough. It won't be enough to really make deep, deep inroads into this delusion. What we then need, on the basis of trying to act more and more skillfully, we need to work directly on the mind, and we do that through meditation. So through meditation, you're working on the mind with the mind. And what you do in meditation, first of all, is create a calm and positive and clear mind. So then this self-clinging, this holding to this delusion of me, starts to loosen even more. So that, in a way, that's what we've been doing. I've been encouraging you to practice more skillful actions in your everyday life, and I've been encouraging you to meditate every day. I've also been encouraging you to do a bit of nothing every day. And in a sense, that's what I'm going to come on to this week. But before I come on to that, the last stage of the threefold path, the last fold of the threefold path, is wisdom. Because even meditation isn't enough. With meditation and with ethics, we can become happier, healthier human beings. We can become more whole, more integrated, where our head and our heart aren't so divided, where our will is in alignment with our heart and our head, where, in a way, we're not so fragmented inside, where we become, as it were, a single, healthy, happier human being. That's a fantastic kind of goal to have, but the Dharma life says that, in a way, that's only the beginning. Because then what you do, on the basis of a clear, calm, healthy, positive, metaful mind, you start to look to undo this root delusion. You start to see through it. You start to reflect on the fact that, oh yes, there is nothing fixed. Who am I? If you ask this simple question, who am I, and you let it drop into your mind when the mind is really, really calm and really, really positive, then the delusion can start to I don't know, dissolve, at least for a while, and then you can start to experience the expansiveness at its sort of fullest. So that's what I was talking about last week. Does that sort of make sense? Particularly if you weren't here last week, this is a sort of undoing of the contraction. The other thing I was talking about last week is that when the mind does expand, and to the degree that it expands, it's got some very, very positive qualities to it. One of these qualities is a quality... Well, last week I was talking about metta and sensitivity, and I want to just expand on that a little bit more. This quality of responsiveness to value, that's what I want to call it this week, responsiveness to value. So in consciousness, in everybody, there is this responsiveness to value. By value, I mean lots of things, actually. I mean things like a responsiveness to truth. We have, all of us, to a greater or lesser extent, a capacity to recognize truth. It's also a responsiveness to beauty. We have a capacity to see things as beautiful and to have a heart response to that. But there's also a response to nobility of action, to goodness, to kindness. When somebody is generous and kind, there's something in consciousness that resonates and opens to that. Yeah. It's also a responsiveness to freedom. We want this sense of energy and freedom and creativity in our lives. And when we're in touch with that, we feel fulfilled. When we're not, we feel kind of stuck. So this responsiveness is a natural kind of quality of mind. The trouble is that it can become dulled. How do you think it becomes dulled? What dulls responsiveness in us in this way?
Distractions, if you have a very distracted mind.
Yeah. Because a busy, distracted mind, what's it feel like, a busy, distracted mind? Why would it dull responsiveness? You're right, but...
And you can't focus on anything.
Yeah.
And it probably, you never let it sink in enough to just settle.
Yeah, that's right. While the mind is busy, come back to you, Denise. When the mind is busy, it is like fizziness. Nothing, we don't give it time for anything to settle deeply enough for the heart to really respond. I was on holiday at the weekend. I went to Berlin for a few days and spent quite a bit of time looking at paintings. There's a Gemälde gallery, and there's so much in there to look at that initially my mind was sort of fizzy and sort of grasping, even though none of these paintings could I ever own or take home. It sort of wanted, do you know what I mean? It wanted experience. But gradually I settled. One painting, a Cezanne still life, I managed to stand in front of and look at for, I don't know, half an hour, 40 minutes. And it comes alive. You know, what looked like, I mean, I know that it's, Cezanne is a master, and but what looked like a sort of relatively kind of ordinary still life of fruit and flowers with a white cloth over a table started to become sort of incredibly fascinating. There was nothing about it that you could put your finger on as a boundary, for example. So the fruit, when you looked more closely, actually it didn't really have edges. It had sort of shadows. Cezanne paints in colour, doesn't he? And without line, in a sense. There aren't any definite lines. And yet, it felt so substantial. You know, you could almost feel the weight of the pear on the cloth. It felt really sort of solid. But the more you looked, there was nothing there. There were just patches of little colour. And then some of the fruit and some of the flowers, they weren't defined at all. There was even a little bare canvas that when you looked at it at first glance, you could see that the mind filled in the gaps. You know, little patches of colour, the mind turned into flowers. It's part of the genius of his painting that he can do that. But in looking, what I kind of saw, looking more deeply, I saw something about the nature of perception, how all objects don't really have that definite edge to them, how in a way everything that we think of as solid is really substantial. Everything that I perceive is really just a play of light on my mind. There's nothing fixed that I can hold. It was all there in this still life of a few pears and apples and some flowers in a vase. And what happens when you look like that is not only does the heart open, not only is there a sense of wonder, but then when I look at something else, when I step out of the gallery, when I look just around me, my consciousness has been changed. There's a certain degree of brightness and lightness and expansiveness that starts to see the world more as it is. And more as it is always more beautiful. And more with a sense of love. So that's an example where you can, in a way, counteract this busy mind by sitting still, or in this case, standing still. Yeah? And just looking. And when I was saying to you, do a bit of nothing every day, you could just look. You could sit in the garden if you've got a garden, or you could sit in the park, or just look at a tree and see what you see. A tree. I mean, that's quite a thing. And this time of year, it's quite a thing. It's incredible. And we just pass them every day and think, oh yeah, another thing. I can remember the first time I came off retreat, or was on retreat, and really saw a tree, and I was blown away by what I was looking at. There were no words that could describe this enormous living entity which was in front of me. It wasn't a tree, just as a word, just doesn't do it justice. So when we start to create a bit of space in our life, we can start to feel more connected to this responsiveness. Beauty is one way this responsiveness manifests. Daniil, you had something else.
Yeah, I was going to ask when you talk about wisdom kind of weakening the delusion of oneself as a separate fixed entity, and that the potential for that to have quite a positive effect. I was wondering whether it's possible if you do weaken that delusion, but don't replace it something more positive, more
central,
more connected.
Yeah. No, it's a really good question. And it's a good question because it's true, and it's pointing to something really, really important. One of the reasons that this path is of ethics, of meditation, and then wisdom, is that you really do need to build a metaful, positive mind before you can really work on undoing this delusion in a systematic way. If you undo the delusion and you're not in a very positive frame of mind, then it can be very disorienting, because, as you say, you've got no reference points. Suddenly all sense of me falls away, and you've got nothing, as it were, to replace it with. what Buddhism says is that we need to start to develop a positive sense of what lies beyond this self-centeredness, this self-clinging. So what I'm trying to emphasize is that when the mind, when you do let go of this self-clinging, I'm sort of doing this because I experience it as right in my belly, this holding on. When you do let go of it, actually the potential is for love and for freedom and for clarity and energy. And it's good to start to get a sense of that potential before you try and just let go of this sense of self. Yeah? In Buddhism, this responsiveness that I'm talking about, this responsiveness to value that I'm talking about, it turns into, when you deepen it, it turns into something called Shraddha. Shraddha is sometimes translated as faith, but really, faith isn't such a good word for it because faith can imply blind faith in things that you can't know. But Shraddha is more like a confidence in your own potential of unfoldment. And it's a confidence that grows as you experience more unfoldment. So this responsiveness to value, as it strengthens, it becomes more and more like Shraddha, more and more confidence. Confidence in the sense of Shraddha also then means responding or having confidence in the ultimate potential of mind. So in Buddhism, that's symbolized by the Buddha. You sort of start to develop confidence that, yes, that is the true potential of mind. This enlightenment that's symbolized by this figure is our true potential. And the teaching of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, this community, are also values that we start to respond to more and more fully. And that's Shraddha. But it doesn't stop there. So responsiveness to value deepens into Shraddha. And then Shraddha is said to deepen into something called Prajna, and Prajna is wisdom. Prajna is knowing. It's not just then a sense of confidence, it's an actual experience where you know, and you know not in an intellectual sense, you know through lived experience that the mind is radiant, that the self isn't what we think it is, that there's something much more to us than we normally imagine. When you know it and you see it for yourself, you taste it for yourself, then there's no sort of denying it. It's a bit like somebody, well, I sometimes use the example of a mango. If you've never tasted a mango, somebody can be saying, oh yes, well it's sweet and it's juicy and it's soft and it's a bit like a peach, but you know, sweeter than the peach and not so furry on the outside, and and you can't eat the skin because the skin would be bitter, but the flesh is, oh, it's like a peach and it's like a melon, da 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 da. Nothing really gets at the truth of a mango. But when you eat it, once you've eaten it, you can never mistake it or forget it. And that's a little bit what it's like about the nature of mind. When you've touched it, tasted it, experienced it, you can never completely forget it. Yeah? And that's when Shraddha starts to become Prajna. But you're right, you have to have a positive view of what lies beyond self-clinging. So if we have a nihilistic view, if we have a sense that actually this body is all that there is, then when you start to reflect on the fact that, oh, this body is falling apart, and there's nothing you can hold on to, and that it's going to end in the death of the body, what that could lead to is just depression. Yeah? A Buddhist view would be to say, no, the body isn't all that there is. that the mind isn't completely identified with the body, and actually there's more than there's more than this sense of identity to self. There's something very much more positive going on. So somehow we have to try and develop confidence in that. And that's done partly through reflection, but partly through trying things like meditation, trying things like, can I be more kind, see what effect that has. Does that help? Yeah? Yes. I've got two questions. I'll come to you first, and I'll come to you, Karina. Yeah. Yeah.
That there can just be a real sense of relief.
Yes.
Actually. Yeah. That you're not kind of on your own striving.
Yes.
You know, with a sense of, you know, feeling like you're going along a street with everybody coming towards you.
That's right.
Trying to go against them.
That's right.
That actually it can be an overriding sense of calm when you're not having to kind of do that. And often the distracting thoughts, all those thoughts can feel like, I often feel like they're two hands kind of pressing around
that's
your head
right.
with real tension.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
Once you can kind of let go of that, actually, it's just enormously relieving.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful. Yeah, that's lovely to hear. And I'd like to just expand on that, if I may, which is to say that this sense of relief, you can encourage it. So in the meditation that we did in the first half, where we were just sitting, what I was encouraging was that When you notice thoughts, you allow them to pass through the mind as if they were clouds in this vast sky, but that you don't identify with them. Instead, I was saying, just feel that spaciousness as if you were surrounded by this vast sky. What that does is it starts to, as it were, relax the mind. And then I was suggesting that the body, you could imagine like you were sort of slipping into a warm bath, and really just relaxing the body physically. That too starts to then have an effect on not just the mind but the heart. I was suggesting that you think of something that moves you, that softens the heart, because this relaxing that we're talking about, or this relief that you talked about, is physical, but it's also emotional and mental. Yeah? Finally, and I didn't really talk about this, the relaxing is existential. So it's not just relaxing the body and opening the heart, it's also, in the end, relaxing this grip on me. To do that, you need to be really quite concentrated, but then you can start to just notice the subtle sensations of holding on, or the subtle sense of identification, the subtle thoughts of me, and start to sort of loosen them. So relaxing is a good way of conceiving of this whole project, particularly in meditation. The trouble with talking in terms of relaxing is that you can think that the whole of the Dharma life, the spiritual life, is all about relaxing, and it's not. Some popular teachers taught in this way, and they just say, oh, you know, the be here now school, all you do is just kind of be. And actually, it's not enough. We do need to make an effort. I need to make an effort. But there is a time and a place, and the time and place for making an effort is in our everyday lives, as we're going about our lives. We need to be particularly trying to act from kindness and generosity, and that takes a degree of energy and effort and awareness and sort of going against the grain of self-centeredness. But then in our lives, we also need times when we are just doing nothing and relaxing. And particularly in meditation, sometimes what I say about meditation is that you need to make an effort, but you need the minimum effort to stay relatively aware. You need to be aware enough to know that there are thoughts passing through the mind and I don't want to identify with them. If you can stay aware enough so that you can see the thought and not identify with it, let it go, then you're aware enough and then you just relax. If you're not aware enough in that way, then you're lost in prapancha. And a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about how you work with prapancha. And then that takes effort again. Do you see what I mean? So it's this very subtle balance in meditation between effort and relaxation. If you just relax in a blobby out way and you're not aware, then you just get lost in your fantasy. But if you're always making an effort, then meditation just becomes more tight and tightening. Yeah? Does that help? Good. Thank you. Karina. Yeah.
When you talk about building up a positive sense of what lies beyond identification with just self, and the idea that when there is no self, there is no, you don't see positive and negative, there just is, like what is just reality, and therefore that is almost, you can just accept it because you can just see it as its reality. And then you're also liberated, but in a different way. And I'm just wondering how that sense of something being a positive idea,
yeah,
and the idea that everything just is,
yeah,
is not completely,
yeah,
how that
fits together. So the trouble is that what we've got is we've got lots of different models, and none of the models is adequate. So, for example, I think the confusion lies in what we mean by positive. So what happens is that when we do, to the degree that we do let go of this delusion of a fixed and separate me, the mind becomes free. And the mind itself has some very positive qualities. Not just the freedom, but creativity, energy, love, brightness, a surrender, a calm, an ease, even a bliss. So it's like the mind is there are very, very positive qualities. And then the mind experiences the world, and the world isn't always very positive. People die, people suffer. So what the mind, a very positive mind, can do is respond appropriately to those difficult situations. A Buddha's mind is said to respond to this suffering world by trying to alleviate suffering with compassion. So it's not that everything that is happening in this world is positive. I don't mean that. But I mean that our response can be. And our response, in a way, is our responsibility, and it's mind-made. Yeah. It is, at least when we let go of this sense of separation between me and the world, me and the other. Yeah?
That's the wisdom.
And then the responsiveness is coming from truth, and it's always kindly. It's always appropriate. And it meets suffering with compassion, and then it does what it can to alleviate suffering. So it's not like the world is just hunky-dory. In fact, the world is not. But our response can be more and more true and appropriate and kind and free. And as well as, I mean, one of the qualities of a Buddha is equanimity. And that's a really mysterious quality. So it's said that the Buddha's mind is so big, so expansive, so free, that yes, even though there is suffering in the world, that mind isn't shaken. Yeah? It can respond with compassion, but it isn't itself suffering. And I think that's something to do with perspective. Yeah?
So external influence does not influence internal. That's right.
Because it's so stable. And it's something to do with perspective. An image that, I don't know if I've used it on this course, I can't remember, but the image that is sometimes used is of the mind like an ocean. When you imagine an ocean, imagine in fact an ocean without edges, which is sort of impossible, I guess, to really visualize, but an ocean that's infinitely deep and without edges. That is a symbol of the mind. But imagine that the ocean still has a surface, and on the surface of the ocean there are all these ripples and movements, waves even. Ordinarily, our unenlightened mind identifies just with the surface. In fact, it identifies not even with the whole of the surface, it identifies with one tiny little ripple. And then says, oh, that ripple is me. And then it says, I want to live forever as a ripple. Oh, those other ripples are threatening to get in my way. They're sort of interfering with me. And here comes a ripple that's bigger and more beautiful than I am. And then I get really tense as a ripple. Yeah? And of course, a ripple is a phenomenon that you can talk about as separate, but if you had a truer perspective, you'd see that there was no real separation to be found. And then if you had an even truer perspective, you'd notice that actually the ripples are just the surface, that underneath there's vastness, and that vastness is untouched by the play of the ocean's surface. Yeah? And the surface can be as stormy as you like, but there's something underneath that is untouched. Yeah? So the mind has that potential to identify, to be experienced as the whole of the ocean. Not just the depths, but also the surface. It's not like you leave the surface behind. Yeah? I don't know if that makes any evocative sense, but I'm just trying to give you a flavour of something very, very positive that we let go into. So Buddhism isn't saying, oh yeah, let go of your identity and then die. It's saying let go of your identity, this limited identity, and become truly who you are, which is free. Yeah? Yeah.
And it feels almost like thinking. It's not thinking. It feels more emotional. But it also doesn't feel quite present somehow. So I was wondering what to do about that.
Yeah. Well, what that is, drifty is really good, actually, as a word. It's called drifting, and technically, as it were. it's what happens is that it's a slightly dreamy state where the mind has quietened to some degree and the thoughts aren't so loud and intrusive, but there isn't quite the clarity and awakeness that we're looking for. We're still in a slightly dreamlike, and it's pleasant, isn't it? It's slightly pleasant. I sort of love it in the mornings. I sort of wake up and then I love dozing in this slightly kind of dreamlike state. Very, very pleasant, but not what you want in meditation. So if you notice that, it's really good that you've noticed that, because that shows that you've got some awareness outside of it, if you see what I mean, an awareness of it. So then you need to sort of introduce a little more clarity into that drifting state. And that, even noticing that, oh yes, I'm in it, you can introduce the clarity. But another way of doing it is to make a little bit more effort to focus on the breath, or imagine light in the mind. The mind, when it's really free, is also bright and radiant. So if you just imagine some light, you can imagine it'll wake you up.
The light's going to help me, because sometimes I get colours and
connotations. Ah, yeah, okay.
Eye effects.
Yeah.
It seems to me that it's to do with something that I'm doing with my eyes.
So.
Keep that calm.
Yes.
If I start thinking of light, that
then that's going to confuse it. Well, think of the breath then. Come to the breath and try and be a little bit more clear about the physical sensations of the breath. Sort of, you know how you can sort of focus and decide to make a little bit more effort in the meditation? That's what you'll need. But then you might find that, oh yeah, you have woken up a bit, and then you need to relax again. So in the meditation, it's sometimes about really staying on top of what's happening and thinking, do I need a little bit more effort? Do I need a little bit more relaxation? And playing around with that. Yeah, good. So this week I'm going to ask you to carry on with your kind and generous act, to carry on with meditation. But in the meditation, I'm going to suggest, if you want to do this, that we just do more just sitting in the way that we've done. But probably you're not going to, when you start the meditation, you're probably not going to be in a concentrated enough state to just go into just sitting. So what I think you'll need is to do a little bit of the mindfulness of breathing, and then also do a little bit of the metta bhavana without necessarily all the five stages, to open the heart, think of something that moves you or gladdens you. And then, after about 10 minutes of that, it depends, you might actually need to do it for longer. See if you can just sit, and you sit with this clarity, this expansiveness, as much as you can feel, and you keep letting go. The thoughts will still come, but you start to try and not identify with them. See the thoughts as just thoughts. They're not you. They're just clouds or these ripples on the surface of something. So watch them. Don't try to stop them. Watch them, but let them go. And stay in the body and watch the changing sensations in the body. And notice that that's not you either. Yeah? It's not just thoughts that aren't you. Sensations aren't you. Sensations are just sensations. Just play around with letting go, noticing and then letting go of identification. But you can only do that to the degree that you're concentrated enough to notice thoughts. So if you're not, then go back to doing the mindfulness of breathing or the metta bhavana. Yeah, so that's what I'm going to suggest in the meditation. I'm going to keep asking you to do a little bit of nothing, perhaps just in the day, apart from the meditation, and that will help you connect back with this sense of just sitting and this spaciousness. It'll start to introduce this spaciousness and expansiveness into your day. And then I'm going to ask you to do one more thing, but it's a good thing, it's a fun thing. And that's to every day look for something beautiful in your experience. And if you can, spend a bit of time with it. Yeah? And it might be in the ordinary, in something quite ordinary. I'm not asking you to look at anything fanciful. You don't have to go to an art gallery. You don't have to look at a Cezanne still life. Just look at a tree, a cloud, even just listen to the birds. Look for something where you have this sense of beauty. Yeah? Train this responsiveness to value by looking for beauty. And do that every day. It doesn't have to take very long. If you're already doing the meditation and this doing nothing, this responsiveness is going to start coming alive. So it'll come naturally. Look for something beautiful. And continue this act of kindness or generosity. That's also part of this responsiveness. Good. So let's finish with a period of just sitting for 5 minutes, and I'll try and read something beautiful.